This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Jack Brighton, Jason Croft at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist who has done a lot of writing about terrorism. His name is Peter Bergen. He was born in the United States, raised in London. He went to Oxford University. After that, he moved to New York City. This was in 1984, and went to work for ABC. He covered a number of stories, including the Romanian Revolution and the fall of the dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. In 1990, he went to work for CNN, first for its New York bureau, and then in 1992 to its Washington office. And he covered a number of stories, but certainly one of them that has become a very important story for him, continuing story, is international terrorism. He is one of just a very few Western journalists ever to have met and interviewed Osama bin Laden. He's the author of a book that came out last fall. It was a book that he was working on, in fact, before last September 11th. But when the attacks on New York and Washington took place, the story became much more important, and it went to press perhaps a little quicker than he thought that it would. The title of the book is Holy War Incorporated. The subtitle is Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden. And the book has now come out in paperback with some new material. This is an updated edition. It's published by Touchstone, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. So the book is out there in bookstores if you want to read it. And this morning we'll talk about some of what's in the book and take whatever questions you have. All we ask of people listening is that people just try to be brief so we can get in as many callers as possible. Anyone's welcome to call 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Bergen, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. At the time that you met and talked with Osama bin Laden, it was not a household name as he is now, but that was after the first World Trade Center bombing. So it was at a point where, for people who were paying attention, there would have been some indication that he was someone who deserved attention. What got you interested in talking with him and in following this story?
Yeah, I think my initial interest was I was a student at a university, and I made a documentary about the Afghan refugees in Pakistan, and so I became interested in that part of the world. And then in 93, when the first Trade Center bombing took place, it was pretty clear to anybody looking at that this wasn't just a bunch of disaffected Middle Eastern cab drivers who pulled off this bombing. It was a group of people who had they had one thing in common, a lot of the people who conspired in this, which is they trained in Afghanistan. So myself and some colleagues from CNN went back to Afghanistan to examine the question of where did these people come from and that. And then later in 96, when the State Department issued a quite informative white paper about bin Laden, calling him the most significant financier of Islamic extremism in the world, it occurred to me that perhaps bin Laden was kind of the as it were, eminence grise of that 93 Trade Center operation. I don't think that's ever going to be, I don't think we'll ever really know. I now see 93 as sort of a proto-Al-Qaeda operation. But in 96, I was approaching bin Laden as maybe the guy who was sort of the mastermind of the 93 attack, and that was why I got interested in him and talked to my bosses at CNN about the possibility of trying to arrange an interview with him.
The question that after the attacks took place that everyone was asking, and in some sense people are still asking it and debating it, and depending upon who you ask, you'll get different answers. The question is, why did this happen? Why is it that he and this organization, Al-Qaeda, target the United States? One answer that people have given is the jihad versus mech world answer, that this is a clash of two civilizations, and that is what it is about. In the book, however, I think you make a rather different argument when you look at bin Laden's motivation, that in fact that's, from his point of view, that's not what this is about, that it very specifically is about American policy in the Middle East.
Yeah. You know, I don't have any sort of any ideological axes to grind particularly. I'm much more interested in this as a journalist rather than as sort of a commentator, as it were. And so, you know, just looking at it from a journalistic point of view, or maybe even, from a point of view of an historian, we've got hundreds of thousands of Bin Laden's statements and words on the public record. And there's a lot of things he doesn't talk about. He doesn't talk about the American way of life, the First Amendment, the Supreme Court, the West's tolerance for homosexuality, feminism. He doesn't talk about the drug and alcohol culture of the West. He doesn't talk about Hollywood's pernicious effect on the youth of the Muslim world. All these things which people are sort of either infer that he's against or say that he's against, he isn't. It's very simple. He's opposed to American policies in the Middle East. And I'm not trying to, by saying that, I'm certainly not trying to either excuse, you know, his criminal activities, but I am trying to understand them. And there's so much sort of hot air is sort of, you know, dispersed on this subject, and people don't seem to attend to simply what he actually says. And I take Bin Laden pretty much at face value. He declared war on the United States a long, you know, relatively long time ago. He implemented it to the degree he did. He's been very consistent about why he's at war. Obviously, I think his politics are extraordinarily wrong-headed, and I think that he was able to take a bunch of people from around the Middle East predominantly and tell them, hey, your problems are not the incompetence and corruption of your domestic regimes, which I think is really the point, but is sort of basically it's all the United States' fault, which is, I think, it's a reach of really the first order. Obviously, the United States supports regimes in like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which by any standards are certainly not democracies and don't tolerate any form of dissent. But it is, at the end of the day, it's really the incompetence and corruption of the Egyptian regime or the Saudi regime or so many of these regimes in the Middle East that cause ultimately this problem. It is not the United States.
At the same time, we make this point, you make this point that his motivation very specifically had to do with American policy in the Middle East, and you reject the clash of civilizations kind of explanation.
Yeah.
It does seem to be the case that what he was hoping for, he was hoping to get inspire Muslims elsewhere around the world, though, to join in this. He did have in mind jihad in the way that word is sometimes used, and was hoping for support from outside of this organization.
Certainly, he was hoping to provoke a clash of civilizations.
Yes.
That in fact, Al Jazeera had the only television interview ever with Bin Laden, and the actual sit-down television interview. They never broadcast it for reasons they've never really clearly explained. But in that, the interviewer actually asked Bin Laden very directly, what about this clash of civilizations? Are you trying to sort of provoke this? And Bin Laden says, of course I was, which of course he was. But it turned out to be a total failure. I mean, if indeed we were in some sort of clash of civilizations, we'd be in World War III. There are 1.2 billion Muslims. Even if 10% of them really genuinely signed on to the whole Bin Laden scheme, that would be 120 million people. The fact is, it's a really very small minority. And instead of being involved in a world war, we were involved in a police action in Afghanistan, largely, almost entirely conducted by the Afghans themselves. I mean, the people who were on the ground going after al-Qaeda and the Taliban were, you know, 98% Afghans, and 98% of Afghans are Muslims. So rather than creating a clash of civilizations, which is what he wanted, certainly, we're in a very different, and in fact, if you look, every Middle Eastern government understands that al-Qaeda represents a threat to them and is cooperating enthusiastically with the, you know, this sort of funny war on terrorism or so-called war on terrorism. So I think that in a way, Ariel Sharon provoked a much bigger his actions in Israel and the occupied territories provoked a much bigger public response in the Muslim world than Bin Laden. If you look at the demonstrations after 9/11, pro-Osama demonstrations, they were pretty small, tens of thousands of people. If you look at the demonstrations after the incursions into the West Bank, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in Jordan and Egypt. So, Ariel Sharon provoked a response that Bin Laden, I think, was hoping, which was really, you know, creating a pro-Palestine, anti-American response.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller we will take. We're speaking this morning with Peter Bergen, he is a journalist. He's worked for both ABC and for CNN, has done a lot of writing and reporting on terrorism, other stories as well. He's the author of the book Holy War Incorporated. The subtitle is Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden, which has just come out here in a paperback edition with some, it's an updated edition of the book that was first published last fall. If you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to talk with in Champaign on line one.
Hello. I'm wondering if there isn't a link, though, between the incompetence and corruption of Arab leaders such as those in Egypt or Saudi Arabia and the opposition to U.S. policy in the Middle East. As I understand it, say, for example, in the 70s, at least there was a small group of people in Saudi Arabia, such as socialists or leftists or secularists, maybe they couldn't make much noise, who opposed the fact that their government was run by a family, a monarchy, and they wanted democracy. And then perhaps the fact that the Islamists have simply become the voice of opposition in the Arab world since, say, the 67 wars, since the 70s, when they became anti-capitalist, anti-Soviet, and looked for some Muslim traditional solution. I mean, the fact that the U.S. has supported Saudi Arabia and its regime in order to maintain, their oil supply, I believe that it was Roosevelt or Truman that made an agreement with the Saudi family that they would keep them in power as long as they kept the supply of oil up. So I don't see these two things as being opposed.
I think you're right. I mean, there's a degree of connection. I mean, not in every country, but certainly, in Egypt since 1979, the United States has been supplying, $2 billion worth of aid on most years, and it's obviously, we support the Saudi regime and we give them a huge subsidy by buying a lot of oil from them. On the other hand, I think blaming the United States for all the Middle East problems is sort of like, I think it's really, it comes out of this sort of rather conspiracist mindset that exists in the Middle East, which basically puts the blame for so many of the problems of the Middle East on outsiders. I mean, it is a common view, for instance, that the Jews bombed the World Trade Center. The Jews were behind the World Trade Center attacks in the Middle East. That is a common view. It is also a common view that the United States is responsible for all the problems that exist in the Middle East. And I'm not disagreeing with you that there are you can make certain connections, but it's a very partial piece of the story, I think.
Okay. Right. Okay. So the Islamist view is sort of to deflect everything away from their part of the world and have the big boogeyman.
I think that's part of it. And also,
but they themselves oppose their quote corrupt regimes.
Well, one thing is, Bin Laden is very interested in getting rid of the Saudi royal family, but it's understood almost as a sort of code word that by attacking the United States and its support for the Saudis, that you're also attacking the Saudis themselves. There are these connections, but I think that there was in fact a report which is being released today, which is for the first time that a group of sort of Arab academics from around the Middle East have done their own report on what the problems are in the Middle East, and it's a interesting example of some honest sort of reporting on the problems that exist. And there are so many problems that are domestically caused, not caused by some sort of American conspiracy to.
Oh, no doubt, right? That was reported on the BBC last night.
Yeah.
Okay.
So look, I mean, I think if one of the best outcomes of 9/11 is if more information about the Middle East and Islam in the American world, which I think is true. I think that people are much more well informed, and B, a real debate in the Middle East about what the future will hold. Look, I mean, we thought that these dictatorships in Latin America would last forever, but when they all went pretty much overnight. And I think the same will happen with these regimes in the Middle East. The fact is, one of the interesting things in that, the most interesting thing about that report is that support for democracy is at the same level that it would be in the Western world, in the Middle East. What is different is in stuff about the way in which women are treated. These are kind of the political considerations that are different in the Muslim world for obvious reasons. But the fact is that there is there is a desire for democracy in these areas, and the regimes they have are universally sort of authoritarian, basically authoritarian kleptocracies. Mm. Whose time, I hope, is brief.
It suggests that there. I think that there's one piece of the many pieces of the story that's been insufficiently explored, and that is the problematic and conflicted relationship between the government of the United States and the government of Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
Two governments that feel that they need one another, but I think don't particularly like one another.
I think that's a very good distinction.
Yeah.
I mean, nation states are not like individuals. You and I have a friendship because we're just friends, right? Friendships between countries are based on a community of interests. And the fact is that our only interest with Saudi Arabia is oil. In every other respect, the values of the United States are antithetical to those of Saudi Arabia. And something like 9/11 comes along, and 15 of the hijackers are Saudis, and the Saudis aren't really cooperating with the investigation. And people start saying, well, wait a minute. Why are we in bed with these people? And the fact is, it's a marriage of convenience because oil is obviously the lifeblood of the American community. But I think a recalibration of our relationship with the Saudis is inevitable.
We have another caller, someone on a cell phone here on line 4. Hello.
Yes, I see some similarities between the Russian Revolution and the part that Lenin played, in the sense of Osama bin Laden is playing. There's a certain amount of dissatisfaction with the Tsar back in that time, and there's a lot of political problems, economic problems, and when you associate that with the fact of the vast richness of the oil that's in the Middle East, and it doesn't seem to filter down to the masses, I can see where these perceptions that everything is comes back, that at the root of the problem is the United States, as you just observed when you were over there. Even though these might be irrational, I think that, and even though Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda group is small, Lenin's group was small and it was quite effective eventually. So I think we have to deal more with perceptions, even though they might not be the actual truth, because they are evidently affecting a lot of people, and we're not dealing with that. I think we're putting ourselves in a deeper hole as a result of it, and I'd like to hear your comments.
Well, it's an open question. I mean, will Osama be the Lenin of Saudi Arabia? Right now, I don't think so. He's certainly relatively popular in Saudi Arabia, and the royal family has got a lot of problems. But, they've been around in one way or another since the 18th century. In their most recent incarnation, this is the third sort of Saudi regime, which was founded in 1932. So, I mean, they've got some survival skills, and in fact, I think the Saudi regime had the probably trickiest moment was in the mid 90s, when there was a real. Your earlier caller mentioned the sort of opposition movement in the 70s. There was a real opposition movement gathering steam in the mid 90s, which they seem to have basically been able to sideline to some degree. But will Osama be a Saudi Lenin? I don't think it looks possible. But as your caller pointed out, the Bolsheviks were a small group and they just got lucky at a certain point, and that maybe could happen with bin Laden. But right now, I think that's quite unlikely.
One of the things that you present in the book is some information about Mr. bin Laden, his family background, and it's interesting to think about why it is that he became the person that he did, given that I don't know how many brothers he has, but I don't imagine many of the others of them have the kind of resume that he does.
Right.
What is it that led him down the path that he took?
I'm very suspicious of psychological explanations based on, very little information, and I basically avoided them in my book because we know very little about bin Laden's interior life. But the only thing that that I did put in the book as a sort of partial, an attempt to explain this, is bin Laden's father died when he was 10. You don't have to be Sigmund Freud to say that would have an effect on anybody. His father was a deeply religious man. Bin Laden has continued to be influenced throughout his life by older and religiously motivated men. His mentor, Abdullah Azam, in Pakistan during the 80s, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is his number two right now. These are men who might possibly remind him of his father. And he was also rather specific. Bin Laden himself has specifically said in an interview that his father was hoping that one of his sons would carry on a fight against the enemies of Islam, and he's fulfilling that legacy. So bin Laden feels that he is fulfilling some kind of paternal legacy, and that, I think, is so far the best explanation which I can find for what he's doing.
Do you believe that he is still directing the activities of Al-Qaeda, what there is left of Al-Qaeda?
I kind of doubt it. You know, I don't have any information either way. He seems to be incommunicado right now. So I doubt that he's certainly not getting on a satellite phone to talk to people, because he understands that that is something that, you know, American intelligence agencies are looking for. I would guess he's really not in communication very much. On the other hand, I mean, the sort of the general theory has gone out, which is, you know, attack the United States, and a lot of people have been trained, and we've seen quite a lot of attempts since 9/11 to implement that. So the fact that he isn't in communication doesn't really seem to make a huge amount of difference.
And so we should, in the future, expect more attempts, perhaps not of the level of 9/11, but that Al-Qaeda, you would say that Al-Qaeda continues to be a threat.
Yeah, but I would say it continues to be a threat at kind of pretty low level. I mean, and that's based on what they've done since 9/11. You know, we saw this attack on the U.S. consulate in Karachi, which killed 11 people. We saw an attack in Tunisia that killed 12 German tourists. We've seen various attempts against the American embassies that have not worked out. We've seen the attempt by Richard Reid to try and blow up an American Airlines flight, allegedly, between Paris and Miami. We saw Jose Padilla coming to this country, clearly not on a vacation, but up to no good, apparently, trying to, you know, put together some element of a dirty bomb of some kind. So I think, you know, we can, it's sort of like predicting the weather in the next 2 days. The weather is going to be, in the next 2 days, is probably going to be pretty similar to what it was today. And I think that since, you know, they haven't been able to pull off anything big since 9/11, I'm expecting that they will continue doing these kind of lower level, which are, you know, not insignificant, but they're not, you know, major national security concerns. It seems to me unlikely that they have the ability to pull together a really complicated. If you look at 9/11, it was a trans-global conspiracy. It was hatched in Afghanistan. There were cells in Malaysia, Hamburg, Germany. There were money transfers from the United Arab Emirates. The whole operation took place in the United States. The people involved were Saudis, Kuwaitis, you know, Lebanese, people from the United Arab Emirates, Egyptians. I mean, this was a trans-global conspiracy. It is very hard for me to imagine that that hasn't been disrupted to some significant degree. Plus, it was also a conspiracy conducted over a long period of time. 9/11 first started. The plan took three years to plan, and that's the only wild card. They've got a lot of patience, and you know, did they have one other big one in the pipeline pre 9/11, which may come to fruition a year from now that hasn't been disrupted? I just don't know. But I think certainly what's reasonable to expect is that low-level attacks against American targets around the world is a very reasonable thing to expect for at least the next 2 or 3 years.
We're already at our midpoint here. I have another caller I'll get to in just a moment, but I do want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Peter Bergen. He's a journalist who's done a lot of reporting on terrorism. He's worked for ABC and for CNN. He continues to be a terrorism analyst for CNN. He's the author of the book Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden. It's now been published in paper in an updated edition. First came out last fall. It's published by Touchstone and is in bookstores now if you'd like to read it. Questions here on the program are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign County on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I want to follow up the first line of questioning by the first caller, the U.S. role, and it doesn't have to be the fact that there are conspiracies outlining it doesn't take away from an institutional analysis of what's going on, that the U.S. role has been to prop up these despotic regimes in the Middle East, and how pivotal they are, I think, is arguable, but I think that it's kind of easy to say that it's kind of a fundamental role. The whole context of driving opposition into the Islamic mold is illustrated in Israel, in that when they were trying to discount the political role of the PLO years ago, the Israeli government was actually funding Hamas as a counterbalance, and you know, it's a pretty amazing story. I mean, maybe it sounds like conspiracy, but I mean, that's documentable. It's widely spoken of in the Israeli press, and I think the analogy is. The other thing is that I think that we can't not look at the U.S. role in using the Mujahideen to bleed the then Soviet Union. And I mean, the stuff that is on record from Brzezinski is just astonishing. You know, calling for jihad. And if you want to look at the institutional effect of that, they're talking about rounding up these books in school books, basically, in the madrasas throughout the whole region. It turns out a lot of those were printed, but with U.S. funds. They were at the time used to inspire people to jihad at that time against the Russians. But anybody that was looking closely at what was going on had to calculate there would be some kind of not insignificant blowback, and I think here we are.
Hmm. Well, the caller's raised a number of questions, Mr. Bergen. Can you comment on them?
Yeah, the last series of points I think is very interesting. I devote a chapter in my book to looking at this whole question of what is the culpability of the United States government or the CIA in terms of this question of blowback, and I have basically three levels of answer. First of all, the CIA's operation to fund the Afghan resistance during the 80s was a brilliant success on a strategic level. It was the Soviet Union withdrew. It was something when the Soviets invaded, by the way, in 79, no one expected that the Soviets would ever withdraw, that it would even be possible. The fact that the Soviet army had to withdraw by 1989 was kind of one of the final blows in the coffin of the Soviet Empire. So, therefore, a very useful thing overall. I think it hastened the departure of the Soviet Union from the stage by a few years. Now, that's on a strategic level. On a tactical level, some pretty significant mistakes were made, which was, A, for understandable reasons, the entire, at least initially, the entire conduct of the war was handed over to the Pakistanis. So over the course of 10 years, the United States government, via the CIA, funneled $3 billion to the Pakistanis, who then decided themselves which members of the Afghan resistance to fund. And the Pakistanis tended to fund groups that were, A, pro-Pakistan, and B, anti-Western. So I think at a certain point during the war, the United States could have turned around to Pakistan, at the point that it was an open secret the United States was funding these groups, and say, look, we want the money to go to people who are, you know, basically more pro-Western and in fact more effective on the battlefield, because one of these groups in particular, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group, which was getting the largest share of the funding, was on the battlefield, was quite ineffective. So I think that was a tactical error that was made. But there was absolutely no evidence the CIA funded or trained bin Laden's Afghan Arabs. Bin Laden's men did fight alongside the kind of anti-Western factions, but there was absolutely no link. For a start, you know, Bin Laden, it's not like he needed American money to help him. There's been a lot of very sort of poor reporting on this subject, which is sort of presented as an axiom that the CIA in some way funded or trained Bin Laden. And the CIA has done plenty of stupid things in the past, like mining harbors in Nicaragua and fomenting coups around the world, but one of them is certainly not in any way supporting Bin Laden and his men.
You think because there was a layer of the ISI in between, and the fact that a lot of, talking about the history, not so illustrious history of the CIA, is it always used, well, almost always used drug and drug money, and the overlooking and the non-enforcement and the winking at drug, a lot of money just poured in into the region. In fact, they talk about the CIA's money being, you know, a massive, I forget how many billion dollars, but if you start looking at what was what went in the way of drug money, I think it might double and triple that amount.
There was a lot of drug money coming out of Afghanistan, but, you know, like, I think there's a sort of general tendency amongst the public and perhaps the media to sort of ascribe to the CIA a much greater role, either for good or ill, in the affairs of the world. And the fact is the CIA is not particularly large agency, which is a fallible organization like many others. And I have no particular interest in defending them, but I am interested in the historical truth. And at any given moment in Pakistan, during the war against the Soviet Union, there were only six CIA officials in Pakistan at any given moment. In Pakistan, these guys were clearly awfully busy if they were doing all the things they're supposed to be doing, which is, you know, running drug trade and training Bin Laden and arming the fact is these people were signing checks and were barely allowed out of the embassy in Islamabad for security reasons. And that's it. I mean, it's a less interesting story than somehow the CIA was responsible for the whole thing. But I mean, sometimes history is less interesting. You know, sometimes the truth is less interesting than sort of the conspiracy theories. And by the way, when conspiracies exist in this country, let's say there really was a conspiracy within the CIA to arm and fund and train Bin Laden's men, it would be out. We live in an open society. Iran-Contra, people, there were hundreds of people involved. They talked, they testified, they wrote books, they got on, they had their own radio shows. Same with Watergate. So, you know, there's just an absence of people out there who actually know anything about it saying that this happened. And, of course, for the conspiracy theorists, this would be simply evidence that it's true because, of course, no one's talking about it because it was so secret. But that's not how this society works. Secrets don't really operate very well in this country. They're not kept for any great length of time if they're of any significance.
I hope I got to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me for going on, but I have other callers and somebody here on a car phone. I want to get to them on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello?
Yes, I'm enjoying the show, and I wonder if you could explain a little bit about the information and communication networks that existed in Afghanistan prior to 9/11. How did these people communicate with each other? Cell phones, internet, you know, could you just, I'll hang up and just listen, but how could they ever communicate in caves or whatever it might be? Thank you.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting question.
Bin Laden bought a radio, a satellite phone, which he didn't necessarily use himself personally, which hundreds of calls were made from to places like London, Pakistan, Iran, Yemen, during the period of 96-98. So the top leadership had this satellite phone that they were talking to their various people on. Below that, I think it's basically you're talking about radio contact. You're talking about handheld radios. There's no cell phone network in Afghanistan. In fact, there are no effective telephones. So it's either radio or satellite phone or, you know, messenger.
And it is the case, though, that people involved with al-Qaeda various places around the world have also used the internet to
communicate. That is certainly the case. And that's not obviously conducted in Afghanistan, but it's conducted in Pakistan from, you know, internet cafes where you're basically untraceable. And, you know, Bin Laden used an internet fairly effectively. A very good example of this is in the summer of 2000, there was a two-hour videotape made by the group, which was really the most effective exposition of their views and tactics. And that videotape was converted into a DVD format. It was widely available on chat rooms on the internet. I was able to download it from a series of links that somebody told me about. And so they you know, using the internet like any kind of large concern was something that they certainly did.
Next caller is Munster, Indiana, line 2. Hello.
Hi, I'm enjoying the show also. I was wondering if you touched in your book on the Carlyle Group, and because I've heard a few things about it, but not that much.
Yeah.
And I was really, one thing that really surprised me was with all the people now that they're interrogating and keeping silent and locking up, that they let all of Bin Laden's family out of the country immediately after 9/11. And I was wondering if you could touch on that, and I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. Well, on this question of the Carlyle Group, I didn't address it in my book. I mean, you know, what I did address in almost like a 6 degrees of separation story, you know, there's some things that are in life that are interesting that don't really mean anything necessarily, and this is the category I put this in. James Barth, who is an old friend of George W. Bush's, was Salem Bin Laden, which is the oldest brother, Osama's oldest brother. James Barth was his business representative in the United States in the 70s. And in fact, James Barth, who was one of the first investors in George W. Bush's first energy company, was doing business on Salem Bin Laden's behalf in the United States. Now, what does that mean? It probably doesn't mean very much, but on the other hand, it's kind of interesting. You know, the conspiracy theorists would somehow, I don't know what they'd make of it, but it shows, I guess, A, that the world is a small place, B, obviously Bin Laden's family is from Saudi Arabia, Bush's family's in the energy business. It's perhaps not surprising that they would have common links in Houston, and that's all it shows. I didn't get into the Carlyle Group, but again, it's the same kind of thing where the Carlyle Group obviously does a lot of business with Saudi Arabia. President George Bush Sr. is involved with them, as is James Baker. But at the end of the day, I'm not really sure if that is anything. At the end of the day, what does that have to do with 9/11? I think the answer is zilch.
And anything you'd want to say about the caller asked the question about members of the Bin Laden family in the United States?
Well, I think that was kind of telling. I mean, you know, the Bin Laden family are very well connected, and Saudi, I guess Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador, got them all out of the country. What does it mean? You know, it's the Bin Laden family were clearly not involved in 9/11. The Bin Laden family members who left, you know, the vast majority of the family is basically, you know, appalled by what Bin Laden is doing. He's turned their family name into, you know, from a sort of, it's like being called Hitler in 1950s Germany suddenly, and that, you know, this is bad for business, and this family they don't like what he's doing. I'm not saying that. It's a very large family, by the way. Bin Laden has 200 first cousins, so it's not impossible that one or two of them are still on, you know, kind of sympathetic to him. But I think as a general proposition, this family is very opposed to him.
We have another cell phone caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I've just tuned in, and I've probably missed a lot of things, but I was wondering, you were talking about basically a kind of a history of terrorism and so forth, and has anybody ever discussed the Stern Gang in Israel, and wonder why you can't find a copy of Exodus? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I don't know what that last comment is, but I mean, I do mention the Stern Gang in my book for the following reason. Menachem Begin, who became Prime Minister of Israel, as I'm sure you remember, was one of the leaders of the Stern Gang. And the point that I'm trying to make when I mention the Stern Gang is that terrorism is a rational choice for a lot of people. And, you know, it would be, you know, I think a lot of people want to think of Bin Laden as sort of a crazed psychopath. Well, certainly his actions, you know, are kind of insane, but I don't think the guy is a psychopath. And he has decided that terrorism is a rational choice. And the reason I bring up the Stern Gang is Menachem Begin was widely regarded by the British as a terrorist because his Stern Gang was conducting operations against British targets. For instance, its attack on the King David Hotel in 1947 in Israel killed 91 people. Most of them were soldiers, but some were civilians. Now, that attack was instrumental in getting the British out of Palestine a lot earlier than they planned. So the point is that terrorism is a rational political choice for a lot of people. I mean, sure, there are people who are just, you know, sort of Ted Kaczynski's perhaps who seem to be kind of clinically, you know, who seem to have some psychopathic problems. But in general, terrorism is applied by people who are hoping to get particular political objectives, and I don't think Bin Laden is different in that sense.
We one of the things that you touched on real quick, or at least you mentioned the name of Jose Padilla, which is the last person that we know of, the last sort of named person who is now in custody because of connections to al-Qaeda. And it is alleged, this is the man who is alleged to have been looking for nuclear material to possibly build the so-called dirty bomb.
Yeah.
And that may again indeed raise the issue of, in some people's minds, the al-Qaeda's interest in weapons of mass destruction, chemical nuclear particularly, I guess not so much biological, and what sort of moves they made to try to secure those weapons, and whether indeed in future that's something that might come to fruition.
Well, they had an intense interest in these kinds of weapons. Luckily, their interest was matched not by their scientific competence, which was, I think, you know, pretty low. I think they were largely sort of scientific ignoramuses that didn't have a clue about what they were doing, but they were certainly running experiments, you know, with cyanide gas, gassing dogs with cyanide, injecting dogs with cyanide. They were certainly, you know, making every effort possible to buy highly enriched uranium. They were meeting with Pakistani nuclear scientists. They had a kind of very rudimentary program in place to buy this material, educate themselves about it. But on the plus side, they didn't have much of a clue. So I think that they, unlike a lot of other terrorist groups in the past, most terrorist groups in the past would never consider using weapons of mass destruction for all sorts of reasons. First of all, they don't want to alienate popular support. They don't want a huge government crackdown. Al-Qaeda clearly wasn't concerned about those sorts of issues. I made every effort to get information, expertise, and material in this area. Luckily, then the program was nipped in the bud. Well, can they do something in the future? It's hard to tell. I mean, a dirty bomb is certainly within their capability. Where would they deploy it? You know, deploying it outside Afghanistan becomes a problem because transporting it is dangerous. It's tough. I mean, Jose Padilla may have been coming to this country to actually find sources for such a bomb, and he might have had some rudimentary understanding about how to blow up such a bomb. But that probably would be a lot easier to just come to this country and find the material than it would be to actually transport the material, which they may have bought in Afghanistan, to this country. That's a whole other order of difficulty, I think.
Another caller here. This is Belgium, Illinois, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. It's interesting that the West seems to portray Islamic nations as less than intelligent. We always seem to think that they have to have such narrow thoughts and stuff. They exhibit the idea that immediately after 9/11, our president called them ignorant cowards, essentially. Well, I don't think that's a very intelligent way to look at this problem, because I think these people are extremely intelligent in the way that they have presented this problem to us and the way that they're prosecuting this problem, in that, yes, they used somewhat high-tech methods to get to us, but they used it in a very low-tech way. In other words, they just hijacked an airplane and ran it into a building, which is really not a very, very high-tech way to do it. You use some high-tech things to do it. And then, since then, they've allowed us just to cause ourselves an enormous number of problems, in that under every bed there's some Al-Qaeda member trying to cause some sort of problem to us. And I think that was definitely part of their way of handling the problem, too, because they realized that we would cause our own problems and cause a lot of our own demises. And we just sell them so short in the area of intelligence when it comes to how to deal with a terrorist or a guerrilla-type effort.
Well, Mr. Bergen, can you comment on that?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't underestimate the intelligence of Al-Qaeda and its top leadership. Human intelligence is kind of evenly distributed around the world, whether in the Middle East or here. So, you know, I mean, the notion... I don't think you can... To me, I think it's indisputable that killing innocent civilians is a cowardly act. So I would certainly agree with the president that... the people who conducted 9/11 or who organized it were cowards. There's no way around that. I mean, it's a crime, and it's also un-Islamic. I mean, the Quran is very specific about the protections afforded to civilians, buildings, roads, etc., even in times of holy war. Even if you accept the dubious proposition that this is indeed a just holy war, which I don't anyway, Bin Laden has exceeded the bounds. And, you know, Al-Azhar University, which is the Oxford of Islamic thought in Cairo, the mufti of Al-Azhar on Friday prayers after 9/11 was very specific about it. It was a sort of, you know, un-Islamic to kill civilians in this manner.
Given the fact that that we know that there are Muslims who did condemn this act, who do not support bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. I think some people have raised this question, would it be possible for us in the West to build stronger ties between a more moderate kind of progressive Islam and us? Would such a thing be possible?
Well, it would be very useful, and there's certainly no reason why it's not possible. I mean, I think that, it's not something that can be done overnight, but look, leave aside the word moderate. I don't think that the West faces a huge threat from fundamentalist Islam. There is a huge fundamentalist movement in this country, and I don't think the rest of the world has to fear very much from that. I mean, the fact that you're a Christian fundamentalist doesn't mean that you're bombing abortion clinics, and the fact that you're an Islamic fundamentalist doesn't mean you're part of Al-Qaeda. Fundamentalism is, there's a fundamentalist movement sweeping the world, and if you're You know, for a lot of people, that may seem to be a problem, but I don't think it is, because you know, these are simply people interested in getting back to the fundamentals of their religion, and that's that. That's that. I think that you know, what is a problem is it, you know, a certain small minority, Christian fundamentalists in this country, attacking abortion clinics, or Al Qaeda itself, you know, conducting its violent operations. This is a problem, but we can have a dialogue with people who are, you know, not interested in violence. We can't have a dialogue with people who want to do violence. And around the Middle East, there are what we would call fundamentalists who are involved in running professional unions or running newspapers or running political parties, who are, I think, interested in democracy. Because there's a certain paradox here, which goes back to some of what we were talking about earlier, which is, a more democratic Middle East might not be a more pro-American Middle East. On the other hand, it might lead to a slightly more stable world.
Just, unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but I did, because I know you've been in West Asia recently, I wonder if you could take a minute and talk a little bit about Afghanistan and its future.
I'm very optimistic about Afghanistan. You know, the country's had 23 years of war. It's a wonderful country. The people are as a general proposition, you know, wonderful human beings. The place is a beautiful country. As you know, during the 70s, it was on the hippie trail. It was a vacation spot. 10 years from now, if everything worked out well, there's no reason why Afghanistan shouldn't again be a tourist spot. You know, the Afghans of all the people in all this, they've suffered the most. 1.5 million Afghans have perished in the various wars that have happened there. 5 million refugees. Country is, you know, one of the poorest in the world. I think that the best thing the United States can do is preside over a real reconstruction of Afghanistan, because it was precisely Afghanistan sinking into a kind of total chaotic morass that eventually that was kind of the germination point for Al Qaeda.
We will have to leave it there because we're at the end of the time. I want to say, Mr. Bergen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Our guest for the program is Peter Bergen. He continues to be a terrorism analyst for CNN, also reported for CNN for a number of years. His book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Holy War Incorporated, The Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden. It's published by Touchstone.